Welcome to Driving Ahead, NADA's podcast about trends shaping the future of the automotive world. Now, here's your host, Jonathan Colleggio.
Hey guys, it's Driving Ahead, NADA's podcast. I'm Jonathan Colleggio, the host. If you're enjoying the podcast, please make sure to subscribe, leave a review if you're enjoying it. Today, we're going to talk about the hydrogen economy, and we're super excited to have our guest, Andrew Hinckley. He's the founding managing partner of AP Ventures. He spent 30 years working automotive, mining, venture capital. He spent time on Ford's executive committee for the Americas and was a longtime exec with Anglo American Platinum, which, as you'll learn, has a big role in the hydrogen economy. So, Andrew, thank you so much for making time to join us.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
So there's so much talk about clean energy right now, not only in the United States and Europe, but also in China and Latin America. We have all these renewables that seem to have had their moment, right? Wind had this big moment 15 years ago when T. Boone Pickens made the big bet on wind energy in Texas. Solar's had its big moment, you know, Solar City and Elon Musk. Hydrogen is one of these things that is sitting around in the background. We're waiting for it to happen. I think 30 years ago, people were saying, well, 30 years from now, hydrogen is going to be powering everything. Now it's 30 years later and people are still talking about it. So we just wanted to get a sense from you. You're a big time investor in the space. Can you just give us a 30,000 foot view of what's going on in the hydrogen economy right now?
Yeah, sure. I think the first thing to recognize is hydrogen isn't on its own an energy source. It's a way of integrating renewable energy into the energy system. And why people have always been excited about hydrogen is its versatility. So you can make hydrogen in a number of ways, but it can start life as an electron, as coming out of the electrical grid, and end up as a molecule in a sustainable aviation fuel. So that's why people are excited about it. It's its ability to integrate renewable energy sources into the energy system in a very flexible way.
So when we think about hydrogen, I think most people think of it as a fuel source. You said it's not. One of the things that I learned from doing research a number of years ago is that hydrogen can be green, but that doesn't mean that it's all green. Some hydrogen, I think, is manufactured from ammonia, which gives it a carbon footprint that's not terribly different than, you know, other hydrocarbons. So am I getting that right? Or can you talk about the different types of hydrogen?
You're absolutely right that hydrogen's been around a long time. In fact, it's a $100 billion a year industry today manufacturing hydrogen. But virtually all of that today and historically has come from fossil fuel sources, from the reforming of natural gases into hydrogen. Clearly, when you take a natural gas or even a coal and make hydrogen out of it, you are left with the other part of the molecule, which is a carbon molecule that's combined with oxygen, and that's where the carbon dioxide comes from. And clearly, with concerns around the world about climate change, that method of producing hydrogen from fossil fuels is an issue. And it's something that the industries that are using most of the hydrogen today, which are the petrochemical industry and ammonia, they're looking to phase out. So moving to different methods, different ways of producing hydrogen. Now, you can continue to use fossil fuels, so oil and gas, and capture the carbon that's emitted when you produce the hydrogen. So that can be stored and therefore avoiding the emission of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. An alternative route for producing low carbon hydrogen or zero carbon hydrogen is to use electricity, renewable electricity, to split water. Water's H2O. So you're stripping apart the H2, the hydrogen, from the oxygen. And that's a very clean way of producing hydrogen. So different methods of producing hydrogen. Historical method produced CO2, carbon dioxide as well. So in the future, perhaps to be avoided. And that's the opportunity. It's to utilize low carbon hydrogen in the energy system going forward.
Now, the zero carbon hydrogen, which you talked about splitting it off, that's green hydrogen, but there's also different classifications like brown and blue. Can you, without getting into too many details, go through those different classifications?
Yeah, I mean, you have this whole rainbow that folks around the world use to describe the different forms of hydrogen. And clearly, some of the lighter colors, perhaps, like green, have lower carbon emissions associated with them. So that's termed electrolysis. The gray hydrogen is the traditional method, so that's from fossil fuels. And the plethora of colors in between is simply the level of residual carbon intensity associated with that pathway for hydrogen production. The US, in its wisdom, I mean that very much factually, has a classification that is simply around the amount of carbon that is emitted when the hydrogen is produced. So measured in grams of CO2 per kilo of hydrogen. It's a very simple, measurable, understandable way of classifying hydrogen rather than ascribing colors to it. It's certainly the one I prefer.
So one thing that, you know, I'm not an engineer, obviously, but one of the things that I've learned about hydrogen that differentiates it from other sources of energy is that it has the capability of creating a very robust type of power that allows it to run super energy intensive applications, heavy machinery, vehicles, heavy equipment, that kind of thing. Am I getting that right? Or can you explain that further?
Yeah, so the energy density of hydrogen is very high. So a lot of energy associated with a kilo, let's say a pound of hydrogen, which is why, you know, NASA has used it in the past, continues to do so to power rocket engines. There's a lot of energy available inside a kilo, a pound of hydrogen. So the types of applications that it is very suitable for, where it's been used, is where you need all that energy in a relatively small volume. Now, to achieve that volume, there are different methods. So you can compress it, or you can liquefy it, or some combination of the two. Typically, historically, there are other methods. So you can combine the hydrogen with a carrier material, another chemical, and then release it subsequently when you need to use it. So there are different technologies associated with taking a gas and making it condensed or compact so it can be used in different applications. Underlying that, however, is there's an awful lot of energy contained in a very small volume when it has been either compressed or liquefied. The types of applications people are interested in are things like power generation, so gas turbines, taking an existing gas turbine engine, either stationary or in an aircraft, and powering it from a hydrogen-based fuel. Heavy-duty mobility applications, such as shipping, are also very much in the target for applications for hydrogen power.
So it seems like almost like a holy grail of green hydrogen utopia would be like to manufacture the green hydrogen on site so that you could supply the energy to nearby big time applications like a manufacturing park or something like that. You manufacture it on site and then it's able to be delivered out to all those applications. Is that something that people are thinking about, kind of like a green hydrogen ecosystem that could power manufacturing and all of these heavy applications?
Yeah, and it's very much, Jonathan, that's the appropriate sort of system thinking that needs to be applied to hydrogen. It's part of an energy system, and it has those advantages of being able to be produced in a distributed manner alongside renewable energies, either solar or wind, transported or stored, and then utilized in different locations as well. So it has the same flexibility because it's transformable between an electron when it's produced, splitting into water, producing a gas, turning the gas back into a liquid, transporting to a point of application, and then using it in that different location, potentially at a different time as well. So that flexibility is one of the primary attractions of hydrogen within the energy system. Its ability to integrate with the existing energy system clearly is very interesting as well, that you can use existing infrastructure as part of the transition to a lower carbon energy source is very appealing. Clearly not throwing away existing infrastructure, reutilizing the oil and gas infrastructure is very appealing. Not making assets redundant, not making capabilities redundant throughout the energy transition is in a very attractive proposition, which hydrogen can provide.
That transportation piece is really what seems to make it flexible, as you say. It does seem that it opens up the possibility to difficulties and even danger. Like I remember the science experiment when I was in the seventh grade where the science teacher had a bottle, like an empty Coke bottle. She filled up with hydrogen gas and then she lit it and it like blew up, which always like this one of these things that burned into my memory, you know, as a 13-year-old kid. How dangerous is it to transport hydrogen from one location to another? Is that something that's manageable or is it like super hazardous?
No, it's certainly manageable. As I said, you know, there is a huge industry in hydrogen today, $100 billion. That hydrogen is moved around, transported, stored safely presently and has been for 100 years. So there are procedures and protocols for storing and transporting hydrogen. But it is, as you say, a substance that needs to be handled within a very strict protocol. And there are different ways of handling it as well. It doesn't have to be handled and moved as a gas, although it can be. It can be turned into a liquid. It can be a hydrogen, a pure hydrogen liquid, or it can be, as I mentioned previously, combined with other chemicals and transported in what's called a carrier material. So the carrier materials would be things like ammonia. So you combine the hydrogen with nitrogen, you produce ammonia, now you have a liquid that can be transported, or you can combine it with another material, such as what's called a liquid organic hydrogen carrier. Essentially, toluene, another chemical, or similar to toluene, and that allows it to be transported as an inert liquid from one location to another and stored using existing oil infrastructure, which is so attractive and very economic as well. So the safety aspects are manageable and the technology is evolving to make them more readily manageable as well.
So the big differentiator seems to be that it can act as a store of energy. So when you create with these other renewables, you have sunlight, so you're able to produce the solar energy, but then the sun goes away and you're not producing it anymore. With hydrogen, you'd be able to create the hydrogen and then use it when it's necessary.
Yeah, and I think when we talk about storage, it's both storage and transportation. The storage piece is, and what differentiates it from perhaps other storage medium, is the quantity that can be stored. When we think about battery storage, for example, that tends to be thought about in terms of hours or perhaps days. When we think about hydrogen, we're talking about up to seasonal storage. So that if you're producing more electricity in the summer and you need it in the winter, then you have the capability to store that quantity of energy for that period of time. So it's a much more capable, greater capacity for energy storage as presented in hydrogen versus next best alternatives.
So the hypothesis for green hydrogen creation would be that you would use, this is my understanding of it, is that you would use the excess energy created from renewables in, you know, sunlight, solar, not used in the day. You put that toward the processing and the creation of hydrogen, and then it's stored to be used whenever it's needed. So you're actually able to manufacture the gas without using carbon to do so.
That's correct. Yeah. And you can then use it in a multitude of different applications, either replacing its existing applications. So it's used in the petrochemical industry, as I described, or in new applications as well, either as hydrogen itself or alternatively as a low carbon chemical or fuel. And it's particularly in that latter area that it has gained a lot of interest and traction in the last couple of years, in low carbon fuels, particularly for the aviation sector, but also potentially for heavy duty transportation as well.
As an investor, those are the areas, those are the practical applications where you see the most use for it is in, it sounds like transportation, heavy duty transportation. You've mentioned aviation and shipping a couple of times. Where else can it be used?
So certainly aviation and shipping opportunities. It can be used in terms of the transportation sector, heavy duty transportation, down to, I'd say, you know, the medium duty, the sort of heavy duty pickup trucks, F-250s, F-150s. I think that sector has ideal applications where the duty cycle is demanding, where the challenges that the customer has in front of them are much more energy intensive. Those are the types of applications in the mobility sector, be it a ship, a train, an aircraft, or a heavy-duty truck, where hydrogen really comes into its own.
So we're obviously in the automotive industry. We represent both light and heavy-duty dealerships. And so to me, it seems like the heavy-duty Class 8 trucks, which I don't know what they are in Europe, but those are the big 18-wheel trucks here in the United States. It seems like those would be a great application for green hydrogen. They would be able to be refilled quickly. You know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, making these 18-wheelers powered by batteries, but then you're like lugging around gigantic, heavy, heavy batteries that take a long time to charge. Whereas with using a hydrogen application to be able to be refueled more quickly, what are your thoughts on specifically for, you know, kind of the Class 8 heavy duty trucks?
Yeah, I'm really excited about the use of hydrogen in that specific sector. There are three different uses for hydrogen, three different alternatives you have in the Class 8 truck sector. You know, a lot of people talk about fuel cell trucks. That's certainly one of them. The second one is to convert, and I really like this, existing diesel-powered Class 8 trucks to dual-fuel applications. So that allows you to take an existing fleet and progressively reduce it, the carbon intensity of the fleet. So you are modifying the fuel injector system, you're adding some hydrogen tanks to the truck, and then you're injecting a blend of hydrogen and diesel into the combustion system. I like that very much as a transition opportunity. And then the third one, which can be used in combination with the second, is to utilize low carbon fuels. So these are fuels that are produced by the combination of low carbon hydrogen, green hydrogen, if you will, and captured carbon dioxide. So it's recycled carbon dioxide, and you're producing a low carbon fuel. So those are the three pathways. The second and third are used in combination. And they sort of work together in the energy system, enabling people to make a progressive transition rather than jumping off the edge of the cliff into a low carbon future, which may work in some applications, right? But there is a cost associated with all of this. And there's a whole group of assets that we are in danger of making redundant and retiring before their time. So to the extent that we can blend our way into a new world order, let's say, that is low carbon intensity, I think we actually accelerate the transition. We get more people moving in a thoughtful manner in the same direction more quickly than they might otherwise do. It's about a proposition, finding a proposition that works for more people sooner rather than a few people who happen to be lucky enough to be in a niche where it makes most sense to them. So yeah, I think Class 8 trucks with different technology applications for hydrogen is a really sweet spot, if you will, in the next 5-10 years.
It's a really interesting hypothesis. I hadn't heard it before. It also, like, if you could localize the transportation routes, you would also be able to more gradually transition into stations that would be able to service and fill these trucks. I remember everybody always talks about how it's kind of a chicken and egg problem. You can't have hydrogen vehicles until you have the hydrogen infrastructure, but you can't put out the infrastructure until you have a market for the fuel. This was an issue like 15 years ago. It was that period of time where oil just absolutely spiked, 2007, 2008. And they were talking about transitioning the fleet to natural gas. And there were states that were creating that infrastructure localized to allow them to do that. It seems like that would be a way to allow kind of a gradual building of the infrastructure localized and then kind of build it out more nationally.
Yeah, I think, you know, a localized back to base model clearly has a lot of merit. So if you are staying with us in a certain region and coming back to a refueling station that provides you with an alternate fuel, a new fuel, clearly that makes a lot of sense. But if you really think about it, a dual fuel truck that runs on your existing diesel and hydrogen is a far more robust way to transition, because you can decide how much hydrogen you want to blend in on present technology, typically up to about 40%. But let's say you run out of hydrogen, you're halfway across the country and there isn't a gas station that's selling hydrogen, it's only selling diesel. then you're back to 100% diesel until you come to another station, right, and you decide you want to fill up your hydrogen tanks. So that flexibility of deciding how much hydrogen you're going to use, it determines the economics, because your hydrogen is going to be a bit more expensive than your equivalent diesel. So you can decide how much you want to blend. And it makes you far more robust in terms of availability as well, to address that chicken and egg.
Yes.
You know, it's a big issue. And I know this because I've looked at investing in refueling stations using hydrogen. That asset utilization on the hydrogen refueling side is real hard case to make unless it's part of a broader traditional fuel offering. And then you are offering a hydrogen potentially as a loss leader, and it's attracting maybe some incremental customers to the rest of your product offering, be it the fuel or the other services at the gas station. But hydrogen alone is a real difficult economic case to make. Again, so blending, you know, having that flexibility at the gas station is very, very attractive. And on the vehicle, it's very attractive as well. In fact, I was in New Zealand at the end of last year, and we have an investment down there in a company who's providing some of the tanks and ancillary equipment for a freight operator who is running exactly this system. Now, the benefit of being in New Zealand, perhaps to your earlier point, is that you have a fixed geography that you're working within. So it's not, you know, a vast route that you are trying to cover. So there is that natural advantage of being in that specific location. You also have the situation there where the fleet operator also owns, I think, about 30% of the refueling stations in the region as well. But they have got a very thoughtful strategy towards transitioning their fleet from diesel to hydrogen over time. And it starts with dual fuel vehicles. And they then, you know, are progressively moving from a relatively small blend. And this depends on what their end customer is actually looking for, because they're moving freight for end customers, maybe sheep farmers, it may be steel riggers, etc. And they'll decide, they're allowed to decide, they have the flexibility to decide what their carbon footprint associated with their freight is going to look like. And then the haulier can then turn up or turn down the hydrogen blend with the diesel to suit that customer's footprint requests, if you will. It's working incredibly well. They're making money out of it.
Wow.
Now, I've asked the group, you know, how in this transition, knowing that these things cost more from day one, how are you making money? Well, firstly, they have a very good marketing narrative around this. You know, they are providing their end customers with a narrative around how they're reducing their carbon footprint, which the ultimate customer actually appreciates and is willing to pay a little bit more for.
Sure.
But that's not really where they're making the most money. By getting low carbon ready, they're appealing to a wider group of potential customers. And as I mentioned, they are a large refueling network owner. They're actually seeing their diesel sales increase because they've positioned themselves ready for the energy transition. So they're attracting more traditional fleet operators to their refueling stations because they are demonstrating that capability over time to transition everyone to a lower carbon future, a far more inclusive and, I would say, economically rational approach to the energy transition. No one's assets are being retired early. They are being moved at a logical and rational pace to a low carbon alternative. So it's working very well for them.
Where else is that being used? Are there any experiments with that in the United States or in Europe that you're aware of?
I'm not familiar with any in the United States at the moment, but I have seen in Sweden in particular, trials in Sweden. So it may be a transition technology,
sure,
but the life cycle of some of the fleet in different parts of the world is long. You know, it's 20, 25 years. So it's a transition technology that has a reasonable life cycle.
That's all very interesting. I wasn't aware of that. If we could talk about light duty and what you think the applications might be there. I know that it's worked in Japan. They have limited success there, I think, because Toyota and Honda are so intertwined with Japanese society and government, and they don't want to be held hostage to the Chinese battery supply chain. How is light duty going worldwide, specifically in Japan, with regard to hydrogen?
As you mentioned, Toyota has the Toyota Mirai. Hyundai out of South Korea have Nexo. There are a number of other manufacturers who have either present offerings or future offerings of light-duty vehicles. They are interesting vehicles to drive. They drive like any other vehicle. I had a Mirai for 3 years, and it's a great car.
Was there a challenge doing the refueling in London?
Well, I was very fortunate, but I'm quite unique. I live within 7 miles of three different hydrogen refueling stations.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Associated with Shell. Because you're right, Jonathan, you need to have the refueling infrastructure and the vehicles. One or the other is not helpful. So it's a hard case to make unless you've got both. I think both Germany and California have probably the highest densities of hydrogen refueling stations. And you mentioned Japan as well, of course. So where you have it, it's a viable alternative to other low-carbon powertrains. But at the moment, either a plug-in hybrid or battery electric vehicles, certainly in terms of convenience for customers, are more attractive. Japan's an interesting case, and it does reflect the broader system thinking and how that reflects on the mobility and vehicle sector. Japan is very thoughtful about its energy resilience, first and foremost. So it's not thinking about light-duty vehicles in isolation. It's thinking about light-duty vehicles in the bigger system thinking about energy resilience and how those vehicles can be used, potentially as backup power sources for people's homes, etc. So it's a broader thinking than just the duty cycle for the specific application. So it's a societal problem they're trying to solve. They're not blessed in the same way that the US is with bountiful supply of fossil fuels as well as renewable energy. I really, think that playing to the strengths of the nation is really what you should, I would think, be doing. And the existing energy mix within the US, you're blessed with an abundance of fossil fuels and you should be utilizing them in a low carbon way, which implies, carbon capture, which is a change from the past. And that does imply creating fuels such as hydrogen for use in applications. And it does require the development of the renewable energy system as well. But no one should try and kid themselves that it would be wise to walk away from the abundance of fossil fuels that a nation has. I think that would be unwise, would probably be the politest way of putting it. Other countries are very different. They aren't blessed in the same way that the US is with the fossil fuels. They have a different approach to perhaps energy resilience. And there is a big role for hydrogen to play in that regard as well, the resilience of the energy system.
Now, without going too deep, I just wanted to talk a little bit about fuel cell technology. It's not exactly what I thought when I first started looking into this years ago. We're not actually burning hydrogen. It's more of a reaction that's taking place. And the challenge is that creating the fuel cells creates some of the same mineral requirements and headaches that you have with electric vehicles. Are fuel cells as mineral intensive as batteries, like assuming the same amount of power? What does that look like?
Yeah, I think you're referring to the critical minerals in a fuel cell. So
exactly.
So when we were talking about producing hydrogen from water, that's about splitting the hydrogen from the oxygen. In a fuel cell, what you're doing is recombining the hydrogen and the oxygen to create water. Now, it required power, electricity, to be put into the system to split the hydrogen from oxygen in the first place. When you recombine the hydrogen and oxygen in the fuel cell, you produce the power, reproduce the power that you had used to split it in the first place. So you now have electricity coming out of a fuel cell that you can use to power an electric motor. So that's how a fuel cell works. It's the opposite of splitting the hydrogen oxygen. It's the recombination of the hydrogen oxygen and the resultant product's electricity. What's required to do that within the fuel cell is a catalyst. And it's a catalyst the automotive industry is very familiar with, because it's the very same catalyst that hangs under internal combustion engine powered vehicles today. It's platinum and some of the other precious metals as well. Now, the difference in terms of the use of platinum versus other critical minerals in the battery supply chain is we already have the platinum that we need. You know, it's the same platinum hanging under the vehicle. So it's a substitution, right? All of that platinum is recycled. The US is virtually self-sufficient in those metals already because they're all underneath the vehicles. So it's a very different issue you're dealing with. It's substitution. It's saying, okay, I don't need it for an internal combustion engine. I need it for a fuel cell. So a very different equation that you're dealing with for that part of the powertrain associated with a fuel cell in a fuel cell electric vehicle. However, you know, where there is equivalency is in the motors. So you still have electric motors in a fuel cell electric vehicle. What you're not as concerned about is the critical minerals associated with the battery, because although there is also a battery for peak power requirements in a fuel cell electric vehicle, those batteries are significantly smaller than they would be in a full battery electric vehicle. So it is a much more mitigated issue with a fuel cell electric vehicle versus a battery electric vehicle, the issue of, you know, mineral scarcity.
So as an investor, what are some of the hydrogen economy companies that you're most excited about, that you look at, either in the manufacturing space or in the gas space or in the transportation space? What are you looking at these days?
So we invest across the hydrogen value chain, from production to the midstream, which is storage and transportation, and downstream applications. In the upstream, there are a couple of low-carbon hydrogen production companies in the electrolyzer specifically. But we also have an investment in Norway. Shout out to them, Hystar, who do electrolyzers, splitting that hydrogen out from water. But we also have a company that does methane pyrolysis. So that is using fossil fuels and producing low-carbon hydrogen and then capturing the carbon in a solid form. So you can then store that, or you can utilize the carbon for things in the automotive industry, such as the carbon black that goes into tires, or for a aggregate for treating of road surfaces as well. So it's a captured carbon. It's not going into the atmosphere, and then it has economic value subsequently. So that's the upstream side, and a couple of companies there that we're invested in, I mentioned. In the midstream, that storage and transportation, there are a couple of methods for doing that. Ammonia is one. So we have a company in Colorado, just outside of Denver, doing ammonia production using low carbon hydrogen as an input, capturing nitrogen from the air and producing ammonia. The ammonia then is a low carbon ammonia alternative that can be used in existing applications such as fertilizer production, or it can be used to transport hydrogen, essentially energy, to other parts of the world as well. So you can take renewable energy in one part of the world, store it and transport it elsewhere. So that's a very interesting enabling technology. We have an exciting company originated in California, presently doing projects in Texas, that is producing sustainable aviation fuel. Really exciting sector. It's called Infinium. They've attracted a lot of investment from other infrastructure investors, allowing them to do more projects, initially again in Texas, but supporting the aviation industry. So that's a very exciting sector for us. And then a smaller sector, but I find absolutely intriguing, a company based in Michigan, ex-automotive engineers, that have developed a hydrogen storage tank technology that gets away from the traditional use of carbon fibers and uses a different type of fiber and a different type of manufacturing approach that makes it lower cost in terms of capital intensity And the product that they produce is very conformable. It can fit into smaller spaces that makes it more attractive, more useful for engineers looking to package vessels, hydrogen storage vessels, into tight applications, which could include automotive applications. So where you have a package constraint, this is a really interesting alternative to traditional high-pressure storage vessels for hydrogen. So some great innovation coming out of the automotive industry in that regard, a significant investor in that company. So a couple of examples through the value chain that I'm excited about. The high volume, sort of energy intensive area that probably has the most traction, I would say, at the moment is the sustainable aviation fuel for aviation applications. I mentioned earlier the Class 8 heavy duty truck conversions. So we are tangentially invested in that area, but it's certainly one that I would like to get more exposure to when we find the right partner, the right opportunity to invest into. I see that as a great opportunity.
So it sounds like this isn't 30. I mean, like I said, hydrogen kind of becomes fashionable periodically, but it always seems like it's going to be the next big thing. But it sounds like from your perspective, this could be 5-10 years away.
It's right now. I mean, we are fortunate that we've been investing in hydrogen technologies since 2013, and we've had the opportunity to invest and sell some companies along the way. And that has been a great journey for us. We invested in a company in Tennessee about 6 or 7 years ago, helped them develop their liquefaction plant there, and then sold it on to another larger company a few years later. And that worked out really well for us and everyone involved. So it's happening now. I mentioned it's a $100 billion industry right now. So what's going on? What's changed now is that people are looking to reduce the carbon footprint of existing industry. So, you know, that $100 billion has to reduce its carbon footprint just the same as everyone else who's emitting carbon presently. And the technologies associated with carbon reduction that can be economic, that can use existing infrastructure and enable that in a less intrusive manner, are in high demand. So it's happening now, Jonathan, and it's continued to accelerate. Where you will feel it likely is, potentially in the automotive industry, a little bit further out. So that sort of 5 years out, but you're probably flying on aircraft and you don't know it that have a blend of sustainable aviation fuel in their tanks already.
Interesting. It's so fun to hear about. I mean, in the United States, everything is in this binary discussion of fossil fuels or batteries. And it's so interesting and neat to hear about what's going on that's like outside of that binary discussion that seems to be happening over and over and over again. Before we finish up, there's one question that we ask all of our guests. What was your first ride? What was your first car that you had?
I worked for Ford for 20 years. So, you know, it had to be a Ford. I had a Ford Cabriolet and absolutely loved it. And then in Europe at that time, I was also very fortunate. Not my first ride, but I had a Ford Cosworth that probably shows my age, but I had a Ford Escort Cosworth, which was probably the fastest car I've ever driven.
Well, that's all the time that we have for this episode. I wanted to extend a huge thank you to our guest, Andrew Hinckley, for joining us. If you're enjoying the show, please leave us a rating or a review. Remember to subscribe, tell a friend. This has been Driving Ahead from NADA. I'm Jonathan Collegio. Until next time, we'll see you on the road.
This podcast was produced in partnership with Amaze Media Labs.